Welcome to Art Speak Radio. This is Michelle Pond, and I'm here with the woman who really puts the art in Art Speak Radio.
Hello!
Maria Vasquez Boyd. Our guest tonight is Danny Orendorf. He is a curator, writer, researcher, and activist, currently working as the 2013-14 Curator-in-Residence and Interim Programs Director for the Charlotte Street Foundation. Welcome, Danny.
Hi, thank you for having me back.
Thanks for being here. Why don't you start by telling us how you became interested in being a curator?
Oh, wow. Okay. I became interested in being a curator kind of as an offshoot from what I was doing beforehand, which was journalism. So I came to contemporary art or working in contemporary art really because of a frustration I had while working in journalism and going to school for journalism as an undergraduate at Arizona State University in Phoenix. And, you know, that program was really focused on broadcast journalism, and that was very much an interest of mine, working with audio, working with video. And the stories of everyday people, really. And it wasn't until I saw this really life-changing exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago while I was home for a winter break one year, and saw this exhibition by Gillian Wearing, who's a British film and video artist, who makes these really provocative pieces about, you know, life on the streets, like a street-level view of London, working with homeless populations, working with nightlife populations, doing really interesting projects depicting law enforcement, depicting local government, and also really translating the lives and experiences of people in particular who have experienced trauma in their life through these really bizarre and fascinating, you know, front to the camera kind of confessionals, while wearing these masks that cover up any display of emotion on the face. And I just remember coming to that exhibition and spending a lot of time there and feeling like a kinship with Wearing, with her interest in the world and her interest in people and in film and video and audio. And it was the first time that I'd ever really seen art like that. And it made me think to myself, well, if this is what art can be, I want to work in it. And I was frustrated, you know, just being in journalism school, because you were, especially as a young student, learning all the rights and wrongs and all the proper stylistic techniques. And, you know, it was very clinical. And I wanted to do things that captured that kind of surplus of human experience beyond just straight reporting. And Wearing absolutely does that in her work. And so when I got back to Arizona, I kind of naively sent an email to the senior curator of that museum. Her name is Mary Lou Canode, and now she's the director of the Longmire Sculpture Park in St. Louis. And I just said, you know, I don't know what you do, I don't know what a curator is, but I saw this art show, and can I work with you? And she was kind of, I think, humored by just how kind of casual my email was, and we went to lunch and really hit it off, and then I wound up working for her for 3 years, you know, doing research, writing, and truly working with the install teams and the event teams. And the first, really, it's truly working for a small institution like that, you know, in the, I think the first month that I was there, they were putting up an exhibition of street photography, it just so happened, really focusing on Deanna Arbus's work. And I was able to help with the installation of that. And truly within the first month, I was holding in my hands, you know, some of Arbus's work, and at that point I was just hooked for life.
So if someone sent you an email like you had sent to her, and said, I don't think I know what a curator is. What would your answer be now?
Oh, I love those emails. I've received several of them being here, actually, in Kansas City. Some of them, you know, have resulted in people that, you know, volunteer with me or, you know, just we have a conversation. You know, I just had a really wonderful conversation with this senior over at KCAI who was interviewing me as part of her own internship, not with me, but someone else. And, you know, and it's wonderful to kind of give insight into pursuing this career because it's not there's not a lot of job opportunity. There's a lot of competition. There's a lot of education. But at the same time, there's so many different ways, I believe, that people can work as a curator. And, you know, we tend to have a kind of single vision definition of what a curator is supposed to do. And I think that comes from institutional curating and this idea that curators are authorities or curators are singularly deciding, you know, the value of an artwork or its worth or its meaning. And, you know, that's something that over the course of my own career, I really try to challenge. And so absolutely, I welcome all of those emails and opportunities to kind of lend my own perspective on things. So
what's your broader definition of a curator than the standard or traditional definition?
Well, I'll say that my practice has always been artist focused. So I believe myself to be a facilitator of an artist's vision more so than anything else. I don't want to put a layer of my own kind of authority or whatever over their work. And instead, I want to work with them to help realize their vision or make a statement as articulately as possible. So you know, and obviously having a background in journalism and what I consider to be a strong writing practice helps me in that task. And so, you know, I'm not the kind of curator that enters an artist studio and sort of points at things and says this, that, and the other, yes, and those, no. Instead, I sort of really want to get in there and think about what that artist is looking at, what they're reading, what they're trying to accomplish with their work, what the thrust of their making entails. And then truly, there's been so many times in my career working with an artist where I just have said, you know what, here's the amount of space I can give you in the gallery. I trust you. I love your practice. I love your work. Bring whatever you want. And sometimes that's leads to some, you know, sweaty armpits the week of installation. But I love that thrill. And, you know, I think that's brought my work to be really one that has been embraced, particularly by artists. You know, a lot of the opportunities I've received in my life have been because of artists selecting me to write about their work or artists referring me to an opportunity. And and that's really how I intend to work all my life.
Well, like actors will say, well, this person is an actor's director. It sounds like you're an artist's curator.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. That isn't to say that I'm completely hands-off. I mean, and certainly, you know, when composing an exhibition, there are moments when, you know, there's a particular artwork I want to go after. But if that artist is not interested in showing it, you know, that's the end of that conversation. It becomes about what else they can show. You know, so I think, and I think that's an openness that has been really beneficial to me in my career.
So tell us a little bit about the experience that you've had as the curator in residence at Charlotte Street.
Sure. So this opportunity, I have to tell you, is unlike any other in the country that I've seen. And as somebody that, you know, especially upon completing graduate school, was out there doing a job search, this was singular in its vision for what they wanted a curatorial resident to be, in that, you know, there was no expectation in terms of what we were to accomplish thematically. And it really was so open and allowed me to self-author all of my projects from beginning to end. And certainly that's also a lot to do with working for a smaller nonprofit organization that doesn't have a collection, for one, that doesn't have an exhibition committee, and that, you know, pushes artists to be provocative, pushes artists to be experimental, and fosters, you know, these different kinds of visions. And so it was a really kind of wonderful fit to come to this organization. And I think my experience has been one that's been kind of tumultuous. I think that I bite off more than I can chew always. I think as an organization we do that, and that's why I think I fit right in with the crew. And certainly receiving the mentorship and guidance of the previous artistic director, Kate Hackman, was invaluable. It's been so rewarding. It's been challenging. It's been stressful. It's been confusing. But I'm really proud of the exhibitions I've accomplished and proud of the relationships I've formed with artists here locally. And, you know, I hear so many great things about the difference of vision that I bring to Kansas City. And the longer I'm here, the more I believe that to be true. But at the beginning, I kind of always thought that was just, you know, sweet talk or whatever. But, you know, I feel like if I've brought some artists to the public's attention that hadn't been there previously, if I've brought audiences to our galleries that haven't attended before, I really am so proud of that. So,
and can you what are some of the rewards that you feel that you've reaped from the this position?
There's on the personal level, like the personal professional level, like, you know, it's unheard of, you know, the amount of exhibitions I've done in a year and a half. Like, it's just insane. But my portfolio has, you know, literally blown up. And as a result of being here, I've had really tremendous opportunities to write for the H&R Block Art Space on Kate Gilmore's work, on the Visual Artist Award winners, previously for Grand Arts. I'll be writing about Tanya Hartman's work for the Dom. And that has been really rewarding as a writer, to really have the opportunity to be paid for my writing, which other writers out there certainly know that pain. Teaching at KCAI was a really incredible experience to bring a, you know, historically focused class to the liberal arts department there. I formed a really wonderful relationship to students there, one student in particular who is such a talented and incredibly intelligent young ceramic artist named Donut, who I absolutely adore, and that relationship means so much to me. And then working with artists who haven't been out for a while, you know, so working with an artist, Jeff Tackett, was really rewarding for an installation he made specifically for The Stench of Rotting Flowers, the third show I did, that I think made him push himself and, you know, work into the middle of the night in the gallery. And, you know, and I think he sort of loved and hated me for it at the same time. But I know he's so proud of that work, and that makes me proud to have worked with him. And then, you know, and more recently, working with Christopher Leach, bringing some of his drawings out from the 90s that are really emotional for him and so beautiful. That was really incredible. And, you know, I could go on. I guess I'll stop there.
So how many exhibitions were you expecting to do or required to do?
The original engagement was for 3 exhibitions, so in 10 months, which is in of itself a feat. But then when Kate resigned, they asked me if I would stay for longer, and I had received a grant from the Center for Craft, Creativity, and Design in Asheville, North Carolina, for one of my exhibitions, the one that is up currently at La Esquina Gallery called Loving After Lifetimes of All This. And I really wanted more time to work on that. And so this extension gave me the opportunity to spend the summer developing that project further. And, and so that resulted in a 4th exhibition. And that show actually will travel to their galleries out there in Asheville. So, 4 exhibitions in total, 6 when you make it the ones that have traveled, and then I'm working on a current project for our Project Space Gallery called the Craft Care and Justice Hub, which is much more of a event series that's co-organized with the absolutely amazing Nedra Bonds. So talk about a rewarding experience. Working with Nedra has been invaluable to my worldview. And also a curator that's a grad student at UMKC named Anna Maria Kretzer. So that series is kind of like a 0.5. You know, so it's collaborative. It is itinerant. It changes. And so it's not a static exhibition. So that's another project.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Oops. 90.1 FM, supported by Just Off Broadway Theater, presenting A Gathering of Traditions on December 5th and 6th. This is a holiday potluck celebration of diverse traditions and cultures from our community, hosted by Bill Claus, featuring storytelling, stage presentations, and performances by Amando Espinoza, Philip Blue Owl Hooser, KC International Music Ensemble, and many more. All proceeds donated to Redemptress Social Services Center. That's December 5th and 6th. JustOffBroadway.org for more information.
Jobs? There are great jobs in Kansas City with training so you earn while you learn. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we go to the Building Trades Job Fair to find out about union apprentice programs. Then, did you know ALEC, the notorious Bill Mill for right-wing corporate rule, is going local? That's right. ALEC's evil spawn, the ACCE, is coming to cities near us. Find out Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
Welcome back to ArtSpeak Radio. I'm Michelle Pond with Maria Vasquez-Boyd and our guest, Danny Orndorff, and we're talking about some of his work as curator-in-residence of the Charlotte Street Foundation this year. And so, Danny, tell us a little bit about the Loving After Lifetimes of All This exhibit that is currently up at La Esquina. And that'll be up through July 3rd?
Or January.
January 3rd.
That
I'm
would
sorry.
Be a long shot.
No. January 3rd.
So Loving After Lifetimes of All This is a show that considers the intersections of craft, self-care, and survival, particularly for historically disadvantaged or underserved populations. And it features 16 kind of entities. So there's artists, there's activists, there are archives that have donated material, and really it's a show that kind of looks at the real grassroots, homegrown, independently led endeavors for a person or a population to remember, to archive, to preserve, and bring into the future craft techniques and historical subject matter that is otherwise under the constant threat of erasure or invisibility. And so a lot of that show is really inspired by how artists, you know, with a understanding of how a population that they identify themselves to be a part of have endured or have survived over time, you know, learning about those cultural practices and making contemporary work that pays tribute to, that utilizes the same practices, that utilizes the same techniques within their own work. So it's really sort of to say, like, if this is the kind of historical part of who I am and I understand that, what can I do now as an artist or as an activist to carry forth those traditions into the future?
And where does your interest in intergenerational skill sharing come from?
Oh, gosh. I it comes from activism and from crafting. I've been very interested in the notion of alternative families. As a queer person, I'm very interested in the ways that we define our kinships and our affective bonds outside of heteronormative structures. And while I was in graduate school, I was very, very interested in the model of the craft guild. Which is some of the first times that you see businesses, for instance, being transferred down a generation by non-biological lines. And that was really fascinating to me. And certainly, this research I had done into a man named Edward Carpenter, who was a Victorian era artist and activist, and he actually introduced the wood sandal to England and all this really fascinating detail. You know, looking into his life and the way that he practiced apprenticeship of both his political beliefs and his actual trade as a craftsman was really a kind of an inspiring moment for me. And then looking at the art practices of, for instance, a woman named Tanya Aguiniga, who is a Mexican-American artist, originally, you know, kind of from a border experience between Tijuana and San Diego. Her work, I mean, I've worked with Tanya in the past. She is a great friend of mine and an incredible artist. And she, you know, has been doing these projects utilizing pre-industrial crafting techniques in contemporary contexts. And over time, it became increasingly politicized. She works with artisan communities, all female, all women, artisan communities in Chiapas and Oaxaca, Mexico, learning these techniques and then incorporates them into designed objects that both share the wealth of the sales with the women back in Chiapas and Oaxaca, as well as bringing these craft techniques that are truly under the threat of extinction. There's particular weaving techniques, particular felting techniques that are, you know, ever dwindling. And she is kind of elected herself as a steward of these practices into the future and does a lot of teaching, does a lot of collaborative work. And so I knew I wanted to work with Tanya, and I knew I wanted to work with these themes. And I was thinking a lot about work by a woman named or a person named Tina Takamoto in the Bay Area, who had done work around the experience of a gay Japanese American person that was interned in the Japanese incarceration camps, named Jiro Onuma, that was looking into his techniques for survival and his particular identity as kind of a dandy bachelor with a style all his own that turned to craft as a way to maintain his personal identity while incarcerated. And she, Tina had done these incredible performances and object make and made all these amazing objects while performing that research. And so between all of this, I was like, there's a show there. And then, you know, the title comes from a quote by David Wanarovich, in his, who's the legendary AIDS activist and artist, and who talks about the beauty and the incredibleness of seeing people during the AIDS crisis still making gestures of generosity after lifetimes of all of the, after all of this. So there's a line at the end that ends, it concludes with loving after lifetimes of all this. And that became the show.
And you also talk about self-reliance as a byproduct of the crafting or DIY.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think about that in a sort of broad context. So, you know, certainly the Black Archives of Mid-America here and the Gay and Lesbian Archives of Mid-America here in Kansas City, you know, are perfect examples of this. These are self-generated, independently launched archives. I mean, it's miraculous that these things exist. They're so special. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that practice, you know, you have to take care of your own community. You have to take care of your own histories. And I consider that to be a practice of self-reliance, as well as, you know, what Tanya's doing by stewarding these traditions into the future. I also look at things like the Boston Women's Health Collective, Our Bodies Ourselves, you know, people that in the wake of, you know, substandard care or a lack of attention to the specifics of their identities and their needs as a community that, you know, launched something, that did something. And to me, those are practices of self-reliance that harmonize very well with the do-it-yourself mentality of crafters. And that's kind of where all of those thematic lines kind of intersect for me.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about a few of the artists who are in the exhibit?
Sure. Yeah. So I just mentioned, you know, Tina and Tanya, and they're both in the show. Another artist that's in the exhibition that whose work is so interesting and rich in terms of texture and history is Gina Adams, who's out in Lawrence, and she is mixed heritage, American Indian and Caucasian, and became very interested in how tribal histories are lost, and was doing all this research and discovering all of these unidentifiable patterns, beadwork patterns, what have you, and wanted to figure out ways to honor these unidentified patterns, and produces these really so detailed and amazing encaustic-coated ceramic objects, encaustic-coated photographic panels, and she's working on a series of broken treaty quilts right now that mine this history and really point to the kind of loss of the specificity of what this work entails at a moment right now. So Gina is somebody I'm really so proud to have worked with and to know. There's work in there, you know, by Judith Levy, who is so wonderful and such a fun person to know. Her Last Descendants project, and I wanted to include that work, even though it's been shown even in a Charlotte Street gallery and before, in this context, because I wanted to show it in this context because I feel like it shows the kind of creativity that people whose histories have been under-documented or have been invisible have to go to in order to rebuild their own lineage. And how archiving is a creative practice. It is one, especially when you're tracing gay and lesbian or transgender history, particularly when you're tracing the histories that are the result of conquest or diaspora, or the slave trade, you know, are ones where you have to read between the lines. And I love the vagueness and all of the play that she performs in that work.
I don't know if you ever watch American Roots, you know, Lewis Gates, and I think that's one thing that he talks about, particularly with the African American guests that he has, about very rarely being able to actually trace back who their ancestors in Africa are.
Absolutely. And you know, and that's something that was really so fascinating at the Black Archives of Mid-America to look into. You know, I was pursuing this line of inquiry around craft makers that were also activists and, you know, came upon the story of, or what remains of a story of this man, Samuel Eason, who is credited in so many places as being one of the originators of for us, by us style Black social services in this city. You know, and there are news clippings, and that's about it. There's a death certificate. He was a freed slave from Tennessee. He came here before the turn of the century and, you know, started these old folks and orphans homes, and very, very, very little remains about him as a person. He was unmarried. He was childless. And, you know, there's not a lot so that you can find about him. Even a memorial that was erected in his honor out at the Highland Cemetery, I couldn't find, and I searched for it so many times. Well, I searched for, you know, and did all the research at the Midwest Genealogy Center, and, you know, this is what that tribute at the gallery is about, you know, and why it's text, because that's all that's there.
Are some of the pieces themselves, like, say, fabric pieces or things like that, actually records of history?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. So an artist in Oregon, a Klamath artist, Natalie M. Ball, did a lot of research into incidents of conquest of her tribe, and the painted quilts at the gallery, they're two in a much larger series, you know, are very much the results of of her history and her looking into tribal histories and personal and family histories. And then adjacent to that work is work by a really fabulous San Francisco artist named Ramekin O.R. Wisters, addressing the themes of diaspora that incorporate family photographs along this kind of serpentine braided rag rug fiber wall piece. It's really an exceptional and beautiful work. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Rushing round in circles to brighten all the corners, you're busy making friends with all your enemies. You finger through your Bible whilst looking through your window. The look you gave erased a thousand memories. Ooh, I'm sorry. Ooh, I am sorry. This page in your story won't turn. Who am I to ask you why you feel the way you do? If you feel the way you do, is there nothing we could do? With advice I'd warn her, don't idolize your neighbor. Maybe something else is the enemy.
Welcome back to Art Speak Radio. This is Michelle Pond with Maria Vasquez Boyd and our guest Danny Orendorf. And Danny, so tell us, we were talking a little bit about the fact that this show is actually going to be traveling to another city.
Yeah, so the show's going to be traveling to Asheville, and that's kind of the first thing on the horizon in 2015. And I'll be working on a publication for that project, so that's kind of going to be a major focus for me in the new year.
What type of publication?
It's going to be it's a catalog for the show, really, but I, you know, in typical Danny Orndorff style, I can't do a straightforward publication. I really, and again, want it to be artist-centric. So the concept for the publication is to have artists interview one another, and particularly to have the local artists interview artists that are working elsewhere. So, for instance, like I, you know, have been working locally with this incredible activist named John D. Barnett, who was one of the founders of ACT UP Kansas City here, and he laughs every time I call him an artist because he doesn't call himself that. But he, you know, I found out, I met him at the Gay and Lesbian Archives, actually, happenstantially one day. Told him what I was working on, and he was like, well, you know, I actually crochet. And I was like, oh, of course you do.
Of course.
And so we became really great friends, and he makes these things that he calls drug rugs that are the result of when he was on over 20 medications to treat symptoms of his HIV. And he was experiencing what's kind of colloquially known as AIDS haze, and creating these kind of psychedelic rugs. And, you know, and at the time I was also working with, or I had already engaged the gallery that represents a really tremendous artist named Josh Fott, who does a lot of research into the legacies and the histories of home care for and hospice care, and the sort of self-help strategies of those individuals and those volunteers, and makes these equally rambunctious weavings, you know, kind of in tribute to the messiness of those lives. And I really just want to put the two of them in conversation and transcribe it and put it in this publication.
Uh-huh.
So that's really kind of the focus for 2015. And, you know, the center out there in Asheville is incredible. I mean, they're the ones that are behind the prestigious and really well-known Wingate Fellowships. And, you know, they have an academic focus. They have a conceptual focus. They're also very, you know, interested in stewarding traditional techniques. And I'm really so pleased to be working with them. They're going to be bringing out one of the sort of more well-known artists in the show, Sonia Clark, who recently won the Art Prize, to do a lecture with regard to the show. So there's plenty going on out there.
And when will it be opening out there?
That opens January 30th, so it's a pretty quick turnaround.
So and then about a three-week,
yeah,
not quite 30 days.
Yeah, so I'll be ringing in the new year that way. And then, yeah, that show runs until May 23rd. And then at that point, I'll also be working on a project for The Kitchen in New York.
Uh-huh. Tell us a little bit about that.
So, yeah, so The Kitchen, for those that don't know, is one of the most incredible nonprofit spaces dedicated to experimental art production in this country. It's in Chelsea, and, you know, it has a long and incredible history, and I'm working on a project which is an adaptation of Richard Brautigan's novella In Watermelon Sugar. And this project was really launched by one of my best friends who's a choreographer and a musician named Stephen Recker. And Stephen toured for many years with David Byrne and was really inspired by, but also was doing before, you know, these hybrid kind of pop performance pieces incorporating modern dance and storytelling and songwriting. And, you know, is just such an incredible artist. So he asked me to be dramaturg on this project. But, you know, I'm in kind of investigating what that means and how that can become a performance within the show itself.
You'll define it your own way.
I'll define it my own way. And, you know, and I'm interested in researching Brautigan, and I'm also very interested in researching the kind of... so that story is very much about this community of people that live in the wake of this very bizarre catastrophic incident. And everything in what remains is made out of this mysterious substance named watermelon sugar. And not a lot happens in the story, but it's so lush and descriptive, and it's about kind of alternative living situations and, again, alternative families. And I'm interested in the countercultures that did exist at the time that Brautigan wrote this story, which was 68. So kind of going to be doing research into the experimental countercultures of the time and what the sort of like exercises, you know.
That'll be fun.
Oh, it's already so fun. And I'm thinking right now about like how I can make that interactive. And maybe that means leading the audience through some of the kind of experimental exercises that these experimental communities were developing. So we have a artist in residency in May at Denniston Hill in the Catskills to work on that project, and then it opens in June. So I'm so excited about that. Yeah.
You seem to have an optimism in the respect of looking at people and working with things about survival mm-hmm. and resilience.
Yeah, and resistance, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm so totally fascinated by you know, people that work together to invent alternative worlds and alternative ways to relate, and it's fascinating, you know. And obviously these histories you know, can result in some very questionable activities and then some really inspiring and amazing ones. But I love that effort to imagine and to work towards alternatives.
Any project, anything that is just sort of an idea that might have come out of your time here in Kansas City?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
a new project,
yeah,
new idea.
Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, you know, it's just based on the time here, not necessarily because of work I've seen here, but, you know, I'm very, very, very interested in how we perceive the affect of the activist, I guess, and how we often criminalize those that are politically dissenting. And I'm really interested in artists. For instance, this artist named Mary Patton in Chicago did this incredible show at Three Walls Gallery that I wrote about for Art in America that was about the sort of origins of criminalizing political dissent and political prisoners and this kind of thing. And I'd love to go deeper in that subject matter. And obviously, I think that's very timely. And then beyond that, like, I would love to kind of, in terms of Kansas City artists, really think about the practices that are inspired by what I consider to be fiber practices here that aren't fiber practices, or that are, you know, in a kind of expanded definition of fiber. You know, in this, the work that's being done here that is very repetitive and one thing after another and is so sort of based on mark making and variation. So as vast and different as work by somebody like Susan White, you know, who I think is really fabulous, to someone like, you know, Miles Nettinger, you know. And I'd love to think about that tendency amongst Kansas City artists.
Well, thank you, Danny. And the exhibit, the current exhibit, is called Loving After Lifetimes of All This. It's open until January 3rd at La Esquina, which is at 1000 West 25th Street in Kansas City. And can you give us some contact information so that we and our listeners will be able to follow you after you've left the area?
Yeah. So my, you know, kind of tragic website that I don't update enough is DanDannyDaniel.com. So you can find, you know, kind of information based on the last time I updated it there, and it has my contact information. And then with regards to what's going on with Charlotte Street, you can find that at charlottestreet.org, and that includes information about the upcoming events we have at the Craft Care and Justice Hub. So,
Danny Orndorff, thank you so much for being with us. We're going to take a short break.
To Art Speak Radio. I'm Maria Vasquez Boyd, and I'm here with Michelle Pond, who's in the other room saying goodbye to Danny Orndorff. But I'd like to welcome one of Kansas City's most talented and creative people in Kansas City, who's an artist, Laura Isaacs. She is an interdisciplinary artist living and working in Kansas City. And in the early 2013, she founded Isaac and Isaac with musician-composer James Isaac to create large cross-disciplinary collaborative projects. Laura has shown her work in galleries and arts venues throughout the United States, including Kansas City, Santa Fe, Miami, and New York. Laura also received her master's in studio art from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Maria.
So good to finally meet you in person. I know we've been Facebook friends for a long time, and I should mention that we're also corgi mothers.
Absolutely. Most important.
Those things are important. Well, you know, I As I was saying to you out in the green room when we first met, going over your resume, you've done a lot in your short life. And if you don't mind, I'm going to make you blush a little bit and read a bit of what I have of your honors and awards that you won. The 2014 Luminary Center for the Arts Residency Fellow, also the 2013-2014 Charlotte Street Foundation Studio Residency, the 2013 Inspiration Grant, which is the Arts KC Fund, 2013 Rocket Grant, Andy Warhol Foundation, Charlotte Street Foundation, and the KU Spencer Museum of Art, the 2013 Artist Inc. Fellow, and the 2012 Top 5 Shortlist Art Prize Best Urban Space Art Award. Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so that brings us to now. What the heck are you doing now? Actually, I know what you're doing right now. You're working on a project called 10,000 Hours. So if you would talk to me about, and let our listeners know, understand, what does the 10,000 hours refer to in your work?
Sure. So in February of 2011, I started a long-term performance and visual project called 10,000 Hours. It's exploring and documenting the subjective experience of skill development. And I'm going about this by learning to knit. It's originally, the idea came from back in 2008, I think it was, Malcolm Gladwell released his book Outliers that talked about the research from behavioral scientists, researchers, that says that, amongst many things, but Gladwell really focused in on this idea that it takes a minimum of 10 years or 10,000 hours of practice at the edge of your abilities to become a master at something. And it's the edge of your abilities part that really grabbed me, because just doing something for 10,000 hours is one thing. That's a big time commitment. But at the edge of your abilities is pretty awkward.
So it was through this book that you found out about Dr. Anders Ericsson's research on expertise.
Yes. Yeah.
And he was with the Florida State University in 1990 when, I believe, when that came about. So he states, I'm not a mathematician, but it takes 10,000 hours of deliberate practice to become an expert in almost anything. So when you break that down, which I did just right now, just on the top of my head, 20 hours for 50 weeks a year for 10 years equals 10,000. Some may argue, well, that's a high correlation between deliberate practice and hours of practice. It's not always perfect. Does that seem trivial to you, or does it matter?
Dr. Ericsson, that was one of the problems with Gladwell's book is... Gladwell's a journalist at heart, and so there's a tendency to oversimplify. And, of course, behavioral research is an extremely messy area of investigation.
So subjective, yeah.
Because we're humans, and we're messy. Dr. Ericsson, points out that it's, on average, and it varies from... certain skills could be achieved faster, efficiency. But really, in general, it's this concept that it has to be appropriate practice at the edge of your abilities, not beyond and not underneath, and that it's going to take time, a lot of time, and a lot of trying and a lot of failure.
You know, husband, Mr. Boyd, and I, we had this discussion about it, and he had said something that helped me understand in a way, being a visual person. He said, He said, the difference between, and he's a pool player, he says, the difference between an amateur and a professional pool player is that an amateur will set up a missed shot again and shoot over and over till he makes it. A pro will set it up over and over again till he can't miss it.
Yeah.
Is that sort of the same mindset that you're dealing with here?
Yeah. In the research, I went back I have a strong soft spot for primary sources, so I went back and looked up all the research. And one thing that kept coming out and was both for the researchers and for myself, that was, I think, key, is that these people who end up defining themselves or distinguishing themselves mm-hmm. as masters and outliers in their fields, they don't get to a certain level and then coast. They
sure,
are always
sure.
pushing. They're
pushing.
Always searching. They're always looking at, okay, that went well, but this could have been better, and how can mm-hmm. I make that mm-hmm. better? So it's mm-hmm. never really about, like, achieving a finished goal, and you get there, and it's like Hawaii, and we retire.
That,
we keep
yeah.
going.
There's something more and beyond. I'm just going to take a real quick break
sure.
For underwriting, and we'll be right back with Laura Isaac. This is Beth Pike, co-host of Every Woman, inviting you to join us as we discuss Eleanor's Hope. The retirement challenges facing millions of American women simply can't be ignored. On average, women live longer than men, yet their lifetime earnings are generally lower. So join us Saturday at 3 p.m. on 90.1 KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
90.1 FM presents The Elders and She's a Keeper, live at Record Bar, 1020 Westport Road, Saturday, December 6th. Early show from 7 to 9, and a late show from 10 to midnight. That's The Elders and She's a Keeper. The Elders are a bridge between Kansas City and Ireland, and She's a Keeper is a bridge to the next generation of folk music. That's Saturday, December 6th at Record Bar. Advance tickets at kkfi.org/event.
And we're back. This is Art Speak Radio. I'm your host, Maria Vasquez Boyd, along with the wonderful and talented Michelle Pond. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Maria.
Say that again, kiddo.
Hello, Maria.
Hey. It's been a great night. We've got some really terrific people in the studio. One, Laura Isaac, who is an interdisciplinary artist. Laura, thank you again for coming in tonight.
Thank you.
You know, I do want to talk about you. You started off by saying that you had never knitted before, so this was something, a whole new project for you. And I like on one of the postings on your website, mm-hmm. and from November 5th, you stated, it's titled The Dark Night of 10,000 Hours,
geez.
Knitting with Kundalini. You state, from the outside, all it looks like I'm doing is knitting. Explain further what you mean about that comment and sort of what your project is about to help people understand. It's not just knitting.
Right. So I guess going back to the original impetus to do this project was what I do through my art mostly is I use it to investigate it. I use it as a magnifying glass mm-hmm. or as a way to, you know, prod the rubble and look at what's going on underneath. And 10,000 hours seemed like such a great way to do that, because obviously the time commitment, but also it's really making myself be uncomfortable and push my limits. And do it in a really public way through an art project. It's performance artists get accused a lot of bleeding and or being naked a lot.
It's something that leaves one very vulnerable. I mean,
right.
you're out there. And
so I was definitely
open for
looking
criticism
for
and,
a different
yeah,
way to be
sure.
vulnerable, and one that I think is, I think, important, particularly for our culture. It's a way that we don't allow each other to be vulnerable in our society as a whole.
Now, before you began this project, thinking about 10,000 hours and maybe sort of with the goal of knitting in mind, did you look at other artists who use knitting or yarn or crochet, like Magda, say, the graffiti yarn bomber, or, I came across this Miller and Schellenberger husband team that created a performance piece that centers around their queer identity. I mean, did you look at other sorts of fiber artists, for lack of a better word, that use yarn and crochet and and that sort of thing?
Once it took me a while to finally agree with myself that knitting was an okay medium for this. But once I finally, you know, settled down and said, yeah, I've got to knit. This is the only way this project is going to work, really. I then did, you know, pull up, like, okay, you know, my concept of knitting is very craft-oriented. What are other artists doing with this? And I did immediately just start doing searches and found... like Danny, who was here earlier, talking about using craft and craft mediums and fibers in a very activist-oriented way, a very feminist and queer positive movements really embraced fibers, and I think for multiple reasons. There's many reasons, and in many ways, they were some of the reasons that I was hesitant to adopt knitting in the first place.
Well, something that stuck out for me was the piece that you knitted for the Alexander Calder sculpture. Would you like to talk about that? Tell our listeners about that, because it's very unexpected.
Sure. You know? So in 2012, I was contacted by a curatorial team working for the City of Grand Rapids in conjunction with their Art Prize Festival that happens there every year. And they specifically wanted me to come up and do an interaction with the Alexander Calder sculpture. And they also wanted it specifically to be related to the 10,000 Hours project. Mm-hmm. So they wanted knitting. And when they first called me, I remember this phone conversation quite well, they wanted me to yarn bomb, so basically cover the whole sculpture in knitting. Well, it's a 60 foot wide by 40 foot tall sculpture, and they
a big undertaking.
Honestly, this was 6 months prior to when I was supposed to do this. Not only was that not feasible, but I also didn't feel like that was a particularly meaningful way to interact with this sculpture by one of my art heroes.
And so I get it.
I thought quite a bit about, you know, what I loved about Calder's work, and I particularly love his wire works and his mobiles. And I was like, well, what can I do that pays homage to and doesn't detract, hopefully, from this sculpture? And so I ended up coming with this plan for, I believe it was 10 hand-knit ropes that would go up and over and across the sculpture. And where that sculpture is, it's in a very, very desolate, very open cement plain between all these office buildings right off the lake.
So it's sort of maybe like in a courtyard type setting.
Yeah, it's very cold, and the wind really comes off that lake. But works very well for the fact that it picked up all of the knitted ropes and would move them around the sculpture in echoing these shapes and the forms.
Nice. You know, I can see that in my mind's eye, and I have seen photographs of that. Mm-hmm. It's something that would really be lovely in person. You know, we have sculptures here at the museum, at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Calder. You know, all it takes is a phone call. Again, it's something that is really unexpected. So the materials that you work with, is there a specific yarn or knitting equipment, tools that you work with?
Well, at the beginning, I mean, I was learning, so I really was kind of taking in pretty much all I could. But also, I think starting as an artist coming to this project, I had a more heightened sense of quality of materials than I think some others who start out knitting do at the beginning. But now, as I've moved into, I focus now on lace, particularly. I'm interested in what I'm calling the life cycle lace, bridal veils to mourning shawls.
Right.
I work with extremely fine bamboo, soy, linen, and cotton yarns.
You know, and we can talk about this a little bit further, but if you had never approached the art of knitting, how would you have discovered that?
Exactly. it's one of those things that a fair amount of synchronicity, I think.
Absolutely. With that, we're just going to take a real quick break of station ID and a little bit of music. Stay tuned. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And I love being here with you, all our listeners. I'm Maria Vasquez Boyd. This is Art Speak Radio. Laura Isaac is in the studio, and I love being here with Laura and my friend Michelle Pan.
Hi, Maria.
Hello, hello. We were talking about that discovery. Had you not ever knitted before and hadn't pushed yourself, would you have discovered how to make lace and all its intricacies?
Right. I was actually talking about this, I think just last week, that I remember one of the first times when this project began, I went into a yarn store, and of course I was taking everything in. I was trying to be as much of a sponge as possible and looking up yarn stores. Local yarn shops tend to have samples and things that their employees and teachers have knit. And I remember looking up, and hanging from the ceiling was this wedding ring shawl. And what those are full-size lace knit shawls that are so fine and gossamer-like that you can pull them entirely through a wedding ring.
So, wow! If it's that delicate, what is it that they use? What is the material, and what do the needles look like in order to make that? I mean, it almost feels like it's got to be made by little elves or something, right?
The lace yarn itself is, I think most people, when they look at it, would think of it more like a thread. Majority of lace knitters in the United States and actually elsewhere tend to use wool. But I have two strikes against that. I'm vegan, for one, but I'm also allergic to wool. So even if I would use it, my hands would pretty quickly fall apart. So that pushes me to find other materials. And there's a company based out of New York that makes just luscious bamboo, linen, soy, cotton.
I'm all about
yarns.
Bamboo and
and it just gives them this beautiful drape and sheen, and they're 100% natural fibers.
So in your technique, do you find that it shifts, or does it have to change depending on whatever sort of you're feeling, or whatever you're inspired by, or sort of in tune with?
Yeah, it really wasn't until the beginning, towards the beginning of this year, when I finally said, okay, I'm going to focus full-time on lace. This is my trajectory. Even though at the beginning I knew I was fascinated with lace, and every lace project that I took on, I loved it more than other things I was doing. I didn't let myself focus in until the beginning of this year. But at this point, it comes up project by project and necessity by necessity. So I'm currently working on a morning shawl that's beaded, but I know next up I'm going to be working on some heirloom antique lace edgings that will end up working their way into bridal veils.
And please share with our listeners your website contact information, because as we go along, and if you're listening online or listening to an app on your radio or wherever, certainly people can take a look and sort of maybe get a visual image of what you're speaking about.
So my main website, which is currently under construction, you'll find all the information there, but it's not as lovely as I wish it would be, as it will be in 2 weeks. But it is lauraisaac.com. That's spelled LauraIsaac. And then my email is lauraisaacart@gmail.com, and through there you can find your way to the 10,000 hours website. I went ahead and gave that project its own website just because it's so massive. And then from there, the life cycle lace.
Well, and with that, you have posted some footage of some knitting that you've done, and then it's taken apart.
Right. Yeah, I've finally gotten to a point in 10,000 hours where I can start. I've had time to digest a little bit of what's happening to me through this process, and make more conceptual mm-hmm. works based on it rather than just presenting actual knitted objects as evidence.
Sure.
And so, yeah, that one is called Time and Effort. It comes and goes.
Is it stop motion then? Because,
mm-hmm.
but it's done really clean.
Thank you.
Is.
So what I did is I knitted this, gosh, what was it? Like a 9-inch by 10, 11-inch mm-hmm. lace swatch. And then I filmed myself as I unraveled it. And so then I went through into the video and I took out all evidence of my hand unraveling it. So the knitting itself looks like it's working up and unraveling itself at the same time.
Well, you know, the fascination is not only the process itself. And with a lot of artists, to me, I don't maybe always want to see the finished piece, but I just want to see that between the beginning and the end. I want to see that, you know, the work in progress.
Right.
You know. But when I started looking at that, I started, I hate to say this, but I started comparing my knitting skills to yours.
I get that a lot.
Well, this is bad. I knit like a drunken spider. I mean, I really do. With apologies to all drunken spiders out there, but you know, I was really impressed. The other aspect to your website, again, you're talking about the shawls, and what was that website to the shawls itself?
Lifecyclelace.com.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because in when I look at that, it reminds me of work that's been handed down generation to generation.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't look contemporary in the sense that it was just made, you know,
right.
You know, 18 hours ago or whatever. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. The life cycle lace, like I said, I found myself, I kept, not only did I keep coming back to lace, but I also kept coming back to the idea of bridal veils and mourning shawls.
Mm-hmm.
When
you say mourning, is it M-O-U-R-N?
Yes,
or, okay,
as in grieving.
Okay.
Thinking about the ways that we use lace fabric, and the way that we use veils and the way that we use shawls,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and all of the meaning and the history, and that the only time these days when it's really appropriate for most of us to deck ourselves out in lace is at a wedding, mm-hmm. when we are the ones getting married. And that these days, outside of going to a funeral itself that day and wearing black, it's almost like we are not allowed or encouraged to express our grief.
Yeah.
And the grieving period has shrunk so greatly, and that we're not allowed to acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I find it interesting too that with those shawls, mm-hmm. And the mourning shawls, that the work itself is all done in white. At least from what I could tell from the photos and the videos and all that, everything is done in white. Is that a direct sort of choice?
The current one I have on the needles right now is black.
Okay.
So there will be some black, and those colors that are traditional, but they also lend themselves the best to the medium.
Yeah.
I have seen purple knitted lace, mm-hmm. and other colors, and in a really right context, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But really, what resonates with the lace is white, cream, or black.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually currently a show up at the Met in New York. It's all about the history of mourning clothing,
right.
And I'm very anxious to get out there and do some research.
Well, and it's interesting too because with these shawls and understanding that they are mourning shawls. And grieving, in a sense, that they're white. And to me, that takes a whole other sort of meaning because with some cultures, white is death.
Yes.
And, it's so different from here, what we know as, black is what
right.
you wear when, someone has passed. Let me ask you, I'm always curious to know this about artists. Who inspires you? Is there anything that you listen to or read, or do you have outside resources or sources to inform your work aside from, maybe YouTube's and that sort of thing to
sure.
actually construct to learn how to knit? I mean,
so for the knitting. Or
well, just in general, what inspires you? And I know that's
oh
a very
goodness.
Broad question, but, for some people, there's a sound that triggers them that, makes them very creative. The rain seems to be very potent for people who are creative or, there's just different things that all sort of make us create.
Sure. I really am fascinated with, and I know it's a bit of a, hot topic these days, but all the research about the ways that we learn and the ways that our brains actually function and how that
yeah.
affects us and how, who's driving the car, really.
Yeah. well, and of course, I got that sensibility from you, just, what I learned about you and your process and the research and how you came to 10,000
right.
hours. Art and science, does it coexist
Absolutely.
For you in a way that's just heightened?
I feel that art, they talk about different learning styles.
Yeah,
and I feel
yeah.
that art is a learning style for some people. And for me, I think I am one of those people that, mm-hmm. I encounter certain art projects and all of a sudden, there, that's it. I got that.
Yeah.
And I was able to absorb a lot more about that subject or that idea than, of course, I can comprehend things when I'm reading, but there's a certain...
Sure.
There's that certain awe moment when you get it.
And that's what I'm, trying to get you to define.
Because
I'm going to steal that moment from you. Well, I suppose that any artist has certain challenges. What were some of the biggest challenges for you in this work or maybe overall?
In 10,000 hours?
Yeah, let's talk about that one. Yeah.
Okay, well, 10,000 hours, by its very nature, is a deeply introspective project because I am not only just doing the skill development, but I'm looking at myself while I do it.
Sure.
I put myself under the microscope. And as with any contemplative practice, If there's stuff that has been buried or willfully ignored, it won't stay willfully
mm-hmm.
ignored.
Mm-hmm.
And so the beginning of this year, I had a 13-year-old trauma that resurfaced.
Mm-hmm.
And in a weird way, it's not necessarily the fault of 10,000 hours,
uh-huh.
but it certainly was... it resurfaced as a byproduct of all of
mm-hmm.
the self-examination I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Do you think making art or being that introspective, do you think that's a risk that a lot of artists may feel at some time or another, or maybe with writers or photographers? I mean, do you feel like maybe everyone might feel that sometime in their life who are creative, or is it just a matter of as we grow older and gain experience.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think there's that too, but there's actually a really, really great interview with Chris Rock that I think came out this week, yeah. where he talks about, you know, the phenomenon of comedians being some of the people who struggle deeply with depression in our society. But he points out that comedians for a living are looking at society and looking at culture and noticing things. And so are artists, and so are researchers, and doing particular, you know, variants of research. If you are really paying attention and noticing things, it can take you to some dark places. But the thing is that we have to acknowledge these things about ourselves,
sure,
because
sure.
burying it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we're going to take a real quick break. I've got some underwriting, and we'll be right back with Laura Isaac.
Support for 90.1 FM is provided by The Pitch. Do you need a gift for the foodie, socialite, and music lover on your gift list this holiday season? The Pitch Passport includes 5 parties for the price of 1 in 2015, including Sugar Rush, Vodka Vodka, Taste of KC, The Pitch Music Showcase, and The Pitch Music Awards. There are only 100 passports available, and when they're gone, they're gone. For more information, visit pitch.com or call 816-561-6061.
90.1 FM presents the Wednesday Midday Medley 10th Anniversary Party with host Mark Manning. Friday, December 12th, 2014, 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. at Davies Uptown Ramblers Club, featuring the Pedal Jets, the Philistines, and Dolls on Fire's album release party for their new album, Synesthesia. That's the Wednesday Midday Medley 10th Anniversary Party, Friday, December 12th at Davies Uptown Ramblers Club. For more information, kkfi.org/events.
And you're listening to Art Speak Radio. I'm Maria Vasquez Boyd. We have Laura Isaac in the studio this evening. Laura, I have to tell you, I did check out your TED Talk on YouTube. And I'm going to ask you to discuss Disaster Hat 2 and what you learned from that experience. Disaster Hat 2.
Okay.
It's like Sharknado or something.
Yeah, Disaster Hat 2. That was very early on. So Disaster Hat number 2 was like, you know, 100 hours into 10,000 hours. So I didn't know what I was doing. So it was a combination of things where I picked up this skein of yarn that looked really beautiful. It was like lots of bright colors. Well, I hadn't learned the concept then that what yarn looks like in a skein doesn't necessarily look like what it's going to be in a finished product knitted up. So a beautiful rainbow skein very rarely turns into a beautiful finished project. The other thing was I didn't realize that at this point that, you know, it was possible to have a pattern that was supposedly professionally published and have it actually be completely full of mistakes and not actually tell you how to finish the project. So it was this horrible confluence of events of just the ugliest possible yarn. I also, the second title for Disaster Hat number 2 is Rainbow Bright.
That's right, Rainbow Bright.
Mm-hmm. And The Curse of Rainbow Bright, that was it. And then also this hat could never be finished because what they had done in the photo was fake a finishing. And there was no finishing this hat.
Do you go from there, you know?
Right.
Well, so. But you know, it actually kind of lends itself to have some fun, you know, have a little bit of humor. So I could see Disaster Hat 3 being, you know, knitted out of barbed wire and, you know, have like studs and all that sort of embedded into it. Now, have you given any, I shouldn't say it, couch it that way. What are your thoughts about future projects as this one continues?
I always make sure that I have at least one non-10,000 hours related project going at the time. I do a lot of video work. I do a lot of installation. Mostly these days I've been leaning towards video, but installation. I do social media-based projects and performances. Mm-hmm. So I always try and keep my my fingers in other art mediums.
Yeah, and actually, this is a great segue to talk about the exhibition that you co-curated at the Paragraph Gallery. So let's talk about that.
Sure. At Paragraph Gallery, it's now up through January 3rd. And it's a group show that I'm part of, as six of us are involved. We're artists from all across the United States. We originally came together last year for a show in Brooklyn. And we are all artists that know each other and are familiar with each other's practice and are actually friends as well because of social media. So there's San Francisco-based, her studio is actually in Oakland, Maritza Ruiz Kim. And she does mixed media collages, a lot of encaustic work.
Encaustic, if for our listeners, would be...
Maritza's going to hate me for this, but hot wax.
It is. And not the kind... It's very different from the one that you would use to remove body hair.
Right. It's a really beautiful and tricky medium that creates these lush, rich paintings.
Yeah. Yeah. I do want to let... what is the title of the show?
IRL, Internet Real Life.
And again, that is at the Paragraph Gallery, and that is located...
23 East 12th Street.
So you're part in co-curating this.
I'm uncomfortable with the term curating this, really, because I am one of the artists in the show, and we came together as a group. This is more of an artist-created show, but I think more than many artist group shows, you know, we've very much had a specific theme that we are working with that we all deal with in our work naturally. So we came together for this show, and for the show in Kansas City, I was a natural pick as main lead artist because I was the local one, and then Maritza took on quite a bit of the wrangling of paperwork and documents and fielding panicked phone calls from me in the week of.
You know, I can only imagine because, you know, if you've ever curated an exhibition, a group show, it's tough. You know, it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Curators deserve their props.
There's some joy in it, but there's also a fair amount of anxiety. And gosh, you know, and people like me who would always run to the gallery with the oil still wet on the canvas, you know, and warning the curator, don't get too close to that, you know. But that happens, you know. Those are risks.
Yeah. One of the biggest treats for me being hometown, since I was not able to fly out to Brooklyn for the show last year, even though I'm familiar with everyone in the show and I've seen, I'd say most of them, some of their work in person, this was the first time that I got to unpack the boxes and I got them out and I got to see, for example, Carol Samuelson. She does these beautiful LED-based works that are just impossible to photograph. So, I mean, I'd seen close approximations, but ironically, all of this work based on the internet and our connections around it must be experienced in real life to really be appreciated.
Sure. And for our listeners, if they go to a website for Paragraph Gallery, that would be...
I think if you go to the main Charlotte Street website, which is charlottestreet.org,
I believe so.
I believe you will find it there listed under their current events. And, of course, I have a link to it also through my website, lauraisaac.com.
And, folks, if that's not enough, let me tell you about this Laura Isaac. and this is next month. You have a 10,000 hours, 1 year's progress speak speaking engagement Monday, January 27th from 6:30 to 8 o'clock.
No, that was this past year.
Wow. Oh.
Mm-hmm. But I am giving a gallery talk on IRL on December 13th. It's Saturday, December 13th from 2 to 4 in the Paragraph Gallery.
Thank you for making that correction because I had that with Artist Inc. and that.
Oh, right.
So, good. I'm good. I'm glad you caught that. So, again, tell us what the information is on that one.
Sure. Yeah, it's a gallery talk, and then it'll be a brief gallery talk that I'll give on the art and the artists in the show, followed by a Google Plus hangout with the other artists from San Francisco, Manhattan, New Jersey, Brooklyn, all coming in virtually to the gallery to discuss the work. Saturday, December 13th from 2 to 4 p.m. This is a real treat. All of these artists, there's Carla Gannis, who's actually gotten some press from her emoji of Garden of Emoji Delights.
Mm-hmm.
Katerina Wong, beautiful, amazingly beautiful porcelain works. Joni Gagnon's Son Chirico, who has done this series based on Hurricane Sandy and has incorporated Google Maps into the project along with her paintings.
Yeah, so it's more about, it's less about sort of your traditional art in terms of painting or.
Give
me a little snapshot.
Each of us is very different medium. Like I said, okay. Maritza's got the collages and encaustic and assemblages. Then Carla has large digital prints of her non-facial recognition project. Okay. I did some lenticular prints, which, if you remember from childhood, those little bookmarks that if you move them back and forth, they look like they're running or smiling.
I'm a sucker for those.
Oh,
I really am.
I'm so excited to finally be able to make
anything
them.
Anything that's shiny and moves.
There's a ton of different mediums that we've all engaged with, but it's all cohesive in the fact that it's exploring our lives through the internet as it manifests in the physical world.
Very good. Laura Isaac, I want to thank you so much for coming in this evening.
Thank you.
Truly fascinating talk with a talented artist. You've done so very much in your lifetime.
Thank you
coming in this evening. And if our listeners are interested, you can go to lauraisaac.com.
Mm-hmm.
Everything will be linked up there.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
One S, two A's.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I do want to tell our listeners, we are sort of limited on what we found in terms of First Friday. Usually people will bombard us with information about First Friday events and that sort of thing. Right now, there's a lot of holiday sales going on. I have a Gypsy Market Royale holiday sale happening this Friday, First Friday, at 115 West 18th Street and 1531 Genesee Street. That opens at 5 p.m. The Hello Art Small Work Show and Holiday Fair at Hotel Phillips at 5:30. That's at 106 West 12th Street. You know, one of our friends, Scribe, who was on the show several times, he is has put together a benefit for Children's Mercy Hospital called the Hearts Social Club Auction at 2020 Baltimore. That opens up Friday. What do you have, Miss Michelle?
My Arts, who was one of our guests, will be hosting its annual youth show titled Myths and Legends Friday, December 5th, from 5 to 8 p.m. at My Arts Downtown, 1522 Holmes. MyArtsKC.org is the website.
Terrific. Next week, I want to remind our listeners that Whispering Prairie Press will join us. The editor's staff will join us next week. Stay tuned for American Roots, followed by Chamber Music with Dr. Mike at 9:30. At 11:30, we have From Arc to Microchip. Thank you all so very much for listening this evening. I'm Maria Vasquez-Boyd, and honey, I'm heading home.